Human colonization of Mars is inching away from the realm of science fiction and becoming closer to a real possibility. A Dutch effort is signing up potential recruits for a Mars mission to be tracked on a reality TV show.
And entrepreneur Elon Musk said a few days back that humankind needs a second home to ensure survival. He's gearing his space technology efforts toward bringing a million people to Mars, 100 at a time, in a couple of decades.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. So would you go to Mars? Why or why not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. But I have to throw in a couple of cautions here. First of all, it is probably a one-way trip, one-way ticket. And MIT researchers say that in the Dutch plan for a colony, people are going to start dying about 60 days after they land. So there are some complications. Give us a call at 800-642-1234.
Psychologist Frank Farley joins us now to start things off. He's a psychologist at Temple University, former president of the American Psychological Association, frequent guest here on the Ideas Network, and he's done a lot of research on risk-taking and thrill-seeking personalities, a relevant topic for this Mars idea. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So, Frank, what kind of personality do you think would line up to go on this dangerous one-way trip to Mars?
Well, firstly, I would sign up because I happen to believe that if we can get there, we probably could figure a way to get back. But I think that the kind of personality that would do it is what I would call the type T personality, capital letter T, which stands for thrill-seeking. And these are really the risk-takers among us. And, you know, the kind of things that motivate them tend to be things like challenge, novelty, uncertainty, variety. They tend to be very self-confident. They believe they control their destiny. They show independence of judgment. One important quality is they're often optimistic, more fearless than most people, and often innovative. So you package all those kind of qualities together, and I think you've got people who would do it, most definitely. You know, historically, a lot of the great adventures were, at the time they happened, really seen as one way, you know. And people were sort of maybe bored with where they were. They wanted something different, and so they set sail. And so we shouldn't, you know, today we know so much scientifically compared to the past that I would opine that by the time this really gets going, we will have figured out some way of a return trip.
So maybe some of those people who went on a ship-bound voyage to the New World, it may as well have been going to Mars for them back in the 1600s or whenever.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the prevailing wisdom among many was that you look at the horizon and the oceans end and you're going to drop off, and that's, you know, the flat world. And it didn't happen, and they didn't come back in most cases. So, you know, we're learning a lot more about Mars, so the MIT people are pessimistic. I'm not. I'm optimistic. And, you know, if there's water to sustain life, you know, if we can prove any degree of sustainability, you know, then we can amplify that, and we're going to do it. There's just no question. It's one of the key ingredients in the human spirit. I think we'll do, you know, the moon first, perhaps, you know, and get our sea legs, if you will, and then go on to Mars. But it's going to happen. Absolutely no doubt about it.
Frank, I wonder, is there some fundamental difference between, say, these thrill-seeking, risk-taking people and someone like, oh, I don't know, me?
I don't know. You'd have to tell me more about you. you know, you're in the media, and actually media is somewhat risky. You probably have some of these personality traits. You may not even be aware of it. Not everybody wants to be in the media, you know. I mean, lots of people just want a straight 9-to-5 job. They don't want to run the risk of saying something wrong that'll get them criticized on the air or whatever. So you probably have some of those traits. But the opposite of the big T risk taker is what I call the small T. And that person would not, I don't believe, ever show any interest in going to Mars, the moon, or anywhere near. You know, they're just fundamentally risk averse.
So, Frank, I got to ask you, you've already said that you would go. But how do I know that you're a big T and not just a T for talker, somebody who says they're going to go, but when it comes time to get on that plane, you're not going to be the one?
Well, that's such a good question. I don't know. You know, a lot of my research into risk-taking has taken me all over the world, Mount Everest, and I've flown hot air balloons in races in China and in Russia and so on, just to get close to world-class risk-takers, whitewater rafting in the Andes, in South America, et cetera. So, but my thrill is mostly studying these people. And if I were to do something like that, I would probably want to go along as a kind of science person on the trip. And but you never know until the moment arrives.
Now, I wonder if there's a downside if everyone who, say, goes to a Mars colony has a propensity for risk-taking. Could that make life hazardous when you're making those daily decisions and your behavior in that colony?
It could. You know, it may be a key factor to get people to volunteer and to go, etc. But you may want people who are sort of less than, not at the top of the T scale, if you will. And so, you know, successful civilizations require a full range of personal qualities. We need the small T people for stability, for structure, for order, for, you know, to keep the records, to keep the trains running on time, if you will. But we need the big T to innovate and to lead the way in new directions. And so a successful colony on Mars or the moon or anywhere else is really going to require a mixture.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You're welcome.
That's Temple University psychologist Frank Farley talking about risk-taking behavior and possible colonies on Mars.
And now it's your turn. Would you sign up for a one-way ticket to Mars? Are you one of those big T personalities? Why or why not wouldn't you want to go? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We are taking your calls right now on this very simple question. Would you go on a one-way trip to Mars? Why or why not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Elon Musk of SpaceX hopes to build a colony of 1 million people. He wants to ship them 100 at a time. A Dutch effort has been recruiting people for the Mars One project. They'd be tracked on a reality TV show, of course, through training and colonization. Would you go? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Mark on the line in Ironwood, Michigan. Mark, hi.
Hi. I go, but, you know, I told your producer I would go, but then I had to, like, give the little caveat that I would have gone because between 20 and 40 I could have gone. Now I have 3 kids, so probably would have to pass and try to encourage them to go.
See, that's – oh, you would encourage your kids to go?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what if that means they go and you don't see them again? I mean,
guys,
in person.
You know?
I mean, a phone call from Mars every now and again maybe.
Yeah, it'd be rough. It'd be rough. But I wouldn't want all 3 to go, you know. But, yeah, I'd encourage it, a new world. There's more land on Mars than there is on Earth.
True.
I'd highly encourage anybody who's even thinking about it to read the trilogy, this War and Peace of science fiction.
Ken Stanley Robinson.
Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars.
Excellent books by Kim Stanley Robinson. Mark,
they
thank you
great.
So much for the call. Good luck to your kids should they make the decision to go.
They might. They're pretty young.
All right, we've got lots of phone calls lining up. Here we go to John in Houstonsford next. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, good. You got to tell me if you're going to Mars. Are you a big T or a little T?
Well, I think I'm a big T, and I agree with your last caller that I'm 54 years old at this time. But as far as being a big T, I agree with your expert in that risk takers. I myself am a risk taker, and I was involved in professional rodeo for a long time. My comment involving that is that being a risk taker, people kind of said, you must be out of your mind to go and do that and continually do that. And why do you do it? And I think an opportunity like that, not only would I also encourage my children or their grandchildren to do so, I think it would be because you'd be the first ones. You'd be the, you know, you'd be the explorers, the ones that go out there and say it, make history.
They'd write about you in the history books. All right, John. Thanks for the
change, right there.
All right, thanks for the call.
A great story, John. Maybe Mars doesn't look so bad if you've been in rodeo. I don't know. I will go now to Victoria in Kingsford, Michigan. Victoria, hi.
Hey.
Would you go to Mars?
I would go to Mars if I could take my animals with me. But the reason why I would go is because I feel like it would probably be a sort of abysmal failure, and that would be sort of my best shot probably at immortality. I mean, I would be known as one of the few that went to Mars, like the space dog Laika, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a really cool way to go. And other than that, I will probably just end up dying in a car accident or of old age or something.
So you want to be remembered. Victoria, I don't want to leave this hanging there. You would only go if you could take your animals. What animals?
Well, I have my cat sitting on my lap right now. We're driving out to North Dakota. His name is Adolf, but we're Jewish. We're not, I mean,
all right.
It's not supposed to be offensive.
Gotcha. That's okay, Victoria. Thanks for the call. You could have the first cat on Mars. We are taking your calls, answering the question, would you go to Mars on one of these expeditions that are starting to try to recruit people for the future? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234.
Of course, if I know cats on Mars, once it got off the jet, you'd never see that cat again.
Right.
Be hiding behind a rock or something. We heard from Gail on Facebook, who says, no, thank you. I like to keep my feet on terra firma, and I guess that's right here on Earth. We also have a call from Gary, who is in South Milwaukee. Let's go to Gary now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? You ready to go to Mars?
Yeah, I'd go. I mean, think about it. Historically, if you were chosen as a Columbus crewmate, wouldn't you go for that? Or maybe the first settlers in the New World? I mean, just think of it. It would just be an adventure of your lifetime.
Okay, so, but who knows the names of any of Columbus's crewmates? Or are you just willing to...
Well, you know what? In this age with all the World Wide Web, I'm sure they'd have our names all over the place, and they'd be selling our story to every reality show they could find.
Gary, you got me on that one. 800-642-1234. Would you go to Mars?
Brian on Twitter says, no, I wouldn't know anybody there. Fair enough.
Well, not yet.
Not yet. That's, you'll meet people. We'll go back to our callers now with Adam in Oshkosh. Adam, hi.
Good evening. I've, in fact, actually been following the Mars One project for some time and was really excited about it. And if I'd spent about a couple weeks trying to convince my wife to sign up with me, and if I'd succeeded at that, I would have put myself through the application process.
Wait a minute. If you'd succeeded with that, it sounds like you failed to convince your wife to go.
I did. And I was not quite willing to put my marriage at jeopardy to continue the process.
That's good. Adam, I don't want Mars breaking up relationships. Thanks. Venus, though, maybe for her?
I'm not sure. I think the same qualms will probably be up there.
Fair enough. Adam, thanks a lot for calling in.
All right, let's go to Deborah now. And Deborah joins us from Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
You going to Mars?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Boy, that was pretty...
definitive.
And why not? No sense of adventure? You like it here? The tax rates there are too high? What?
It's just, in spite of the shortcomings on Earth, it's just such a beautiful place. And, you know, to our knowledge, there's nothing on Mars yet. There's nothing set up. There's, you know, family and friends here. And I just wouldn't. I wouldn't give all that up to go and explore a new place that has probably nothing on it.
All right, that sounds fair enough. Deborah, thanks so much for the call.
A couple more minutes to take your calls. Would you go to Mars on one of these colonizing expeditions people are trying to put together? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. B is with us in Kimball, Nebraska. B, hi.
Hi.
Would you go?
Yes. Yes, I sure would. And I'm 73 years old, and I sure would go because it would be one heck of a great adventure.
All right. Would you want to take friends and family with you, or just start a whole new page in your history?
No, it'd be just me going.
Just you. B, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story.
Now, it's really interesting hearing all the various scenarios here. Let's go to Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Would I go to Mars?
Yeah.
Absolutely, in a heartbeat.
In a heartbeat. It's that simple. Is this something you've actually thought about, or is this just kind of a gut reaction?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I grew up in the middle of the space race and the Apollo program and the advent of Star Trek. And just the spirit of the explorer has always been a deep call.
Well, Kevin, I think a lot of us grew up in that same age with you, and there are a lot of folks out there who probably feel the same way.
No more time for callers, but I see Jeff from Ashland says he'd go if he could raise money for Mars Public Radio. You can make your pledge. Oh, no, wait. That was last week. Well, thank you for all your calls. Gene, got to ask, would you go?
No, I'm a capital C for chicken.
Yeah, me too. At least leaving friends and family behind, that'd be hard to cut ties. Brittany, give us a nod. Would you go? Nope.
Nope.
Shakes her head. Amanda? In a heartbeat, yeah. She's that.
Okay.
She does roller derby, so she's type T writ large.
You can T keep, for troubles.
Yeah. You can keep telling us, giving us your answer. Would you go to Mars? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about phantom worlds and the Spinosaurus in our monthly check-in of the coolest science headlines with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine.
First, we're talking about Wisconsin's Wolf Hunt, which opens this Wednesday. The hunt has sparked a lot of controversy across the state, and this year marks the third annual Wolf Hunt. This season is expected to run until late February or until hunters reach the statewide kill limit.
Here with us to talk about the often controversial hunt is Patrick Durkin. He's a columnist on outdoor and recreation issues. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks, Rob.
Well, give us some history here. Why has this wolf hunt been so controversial in the state?
Well, it's not just Wisconsin where it's been controversial. Wolves, wherever we talk about hunting seasons and trapping seasons, are real controversial. There's, you know, just something about the wolf that captures people's imaginations from all spectrums. You know, people who love them, people who hate them, and it's just always it's just never a even-handed, objective look at these animals for some reason. Like you just don't get that kind of controversy with anything else out there. You know, wolves are just way atop the scale for emotions on both sides.
And you mentioned other states. So other states do have wolf hunts like Wisconsin now does?
Right. Yeah. Minnesota is the one that's closest to us, but there's also hunting seasons out in Idaho and Montana. And I hesitated because Wyoming is on hold right now for because of a lawsuit. But, right now this season there'll be at least four seasons, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Montana, and Idaho.
As we mentioned, this is the third annual wolf hunt. Previously, the wolf had been in a protected status until it got up to certain numbers. Do we know how the hunt is affecting the wolf population here in the state?
Well, it's definitely brought it down. You know, 2 years ago, the estimate was, give or take, 25, 30 wolves. But 850 was the population 2 years ago, and now it's down around, I think it's down around 660, give or take, that 25, 30, wolves.
And the kill limit this year is set. It's lower than it has been. It's down to 150 now. Who picks that limit? How is that determined?
Well, this year it was determined by the Wolf Advisory Committee, which is basically various hunting groups and also a bunch of DNR biologists and a tribal biologist. And the way it kind of unfolded this year was all the different members of this committee, which is, I think, in numbers around 20 to 25 people, they basically put out – They made their own suggestions about what the quota should be, and then they pretty much drew an average from those different ideas and came up with 150, 156.
And a group of scientists complained last month that the DNR was underestimating mortality among the wolf population. What became of that complaint?
Nothing really came of it. You know, they petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with that. And the Fish and Wildlife Service basically, for lack of a better term, just ignored it. The thing to keep in mind with a lot of these things when it comes to, wolves and grizzly bears is there's constant bickering between biologists on the science of managing these two species, especially wolves, gets really emotional. But I guess personally, you know, having covered this issue for a long time, it wasn't surprising to me. You can almost always find some scientist somewhere who will, you know, bicker and pick at the various numbers that the state and federal biologists come up with.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how permits and this hunt work. I understand, you know, while this number, the limit is 150, something on the order of 1,500 permits are going to be issued. Why is that?
Yeah, correct. You know, they always issue 10 times the amount of what the quota is, assuming that not everyone will get out there and hunt or trap. And then, you know, because our season is so tightly regulated, you know, they have the state divided into six wolf management zones, and as the quota in each one of those specific zones is reached, the state shuts it off. And they've done a pretty good job on that. So, you know, they give multiple opportunity, you know, giving 10, basically 10 tags for every one of the wolf quota. So you end up at 1,500, but a lot of those won't get used. A lot of them will, you know, a lot of people, if they wait too long, the season will be closed before they even get a chance to go out there anyway.
So I assume if I have one of those permits, it's my responsibility to report to the DNR that if I've bagged a wolf and to know if the wolf hunt in my region has been closed.
Correct. Yeah. And the DNR has a website that it's pretty efficient. I check it pretty often during the season. And, you know, kind of watch how the season's progressing. And the way it's gone the last couple of years, you know, like last year and in the first year, the season was closed, you know, in early November for almost most of the state. And especially last year, I think it was five out of the six zones last year were shut down by, I think, the first week in November. And only one season, only one area remained open into December.
Now, one of the biggest controversies when this came into law related to the use of dogs in the wolf hunt. Why was this such a hot point?
You know, hound hunting, I guess I can't answer why it's so emotional, but, you know, because we have a history of hound hunting in Wisconsin, and it's not like hounds have never been controversial. We had real similar, very common arguments back about 30 years ago about hounds being used for bear hunting. And they also use hounds for bobcat hunting, and they use the hounds for coyote hunting. So it's, you know, Wisconsin has a pretty deep tradition of using hounds for hunting. And so when they want to use them for wolves, you know, people really assume there'd be a terrible things happening out there in the woods with, you know, when you go after wolves with hounds. And, you know, really, I guess the point I keep saying is until we've actually done it, how do you know for certain what will happen with these situations? Because, you know, it never has been done. Other states don't have a hound hunting season for wolves, so this is really, new territory we're in.
All right, and how long do you think it's going to go this year, given the lower number and maybe lower population of wolves as compared to the past?
I'm you know, based on what we've seen so far, I'm guessing the trappers will again be very effective, and by, you know, early November, most of the areas will have met their quota, and, you know, if we hold true to form, zone three will be the only one that will remain open into, like, during our deer firearm season in late November and maybe into December. But, you know, what we're seeing now is, you know, we've seen the number of applicants go down each year. It's gone down from 21,000 applicants to 14,500 applicants this year. I think what you're seeing now is the people who are real serious about wolf hunting and wolf trapping who are applying. You don't see all the kind of people jumping in because it's a novelty. Now you're getting down to the hardcore type hunters and trappers who know something about predators. So I guess I'd expect that we'll still see a harvest come in pretty fast and be over for most of the state fairly quickly.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Patrick Durkin. He's a columnist on outdoor and recreation issues with us to talk about the third annual wolf hunt in Wisconsin, which opens on Wednesday. The new documentary from NOVA examines the unique history of the Spinosaurus, the first aquatic dinosaur ever discovered. A new book celebrates animal reproduction and takes a look at how humans interrupt the mating rituals of other species.
These are just a few of the hottest science stories out this month in Discover Magazine. Senior Associate Editor Gemma Tarlick fills us in every month on the coolest headlines from the world of science. And Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, great to be here again with you.
Well, great to have you along. We're going to start out just in time for Halloween. There is a story in the magazine about Phantom Worlds and got an interesting ending. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, actually, it's our cover story for this year, for this issue. And Phantom Worlds is not where Space Ghost lives, but it is this really interesting story about an astronomer who is looking at these planets that should just not exist. Just super briefly, when you think about how our solar system was formed, the Earth and all the other planets circling the sun, we all pretty much formed from the sun's birth, right? Well, this is the exact opposite thing happening. When these stars explode and die, the debris from their like last dying moments creates these planets that then circle them under really horrible conditions. Now, these are not planets you ever want to visit, okay? Radiation, ridiculously high amounts, is just scouring the surface. They are just getting bombarded by all these particles from the remnants of the star that once lived. It's just a horrible place, and this astronomer is studying them in part because they fascinate him, but also because he's looking at, sorry to say it, guys, Earth's future. Don't worry, it's like 5 billion years down the road. But one day we could very well become one of these phantom worlds.
Yeah, a lot of the headlines are about the search for, you know, exoplanets outside the solar system that maybe could be Earth-like. These are clearly not. You mentioned people didn't think these should exist. Why did we used to think that they wouldn't be where they are?
Well, because the kinds of stars they're circling, like pulsars and red giants, should have destroyed any planets orbiting them. And actually, the astronomer that the story focuses on, a man by the name of Alexander Wulchin, he was the first person to discover planets beyond our own solar system. And his achievement, which is pretty impressive, has been kind of eclipsed in the years since because everyone is looking for the exoplanet that could be the next Earth. You know what I mean? The place we're most likely looking for life as we know it. And he's most interested in these planets in these very extreme environments because he wants to find out, really, what are the limits of how planets can form and how they can survive.
And he is described in the article as being both really pessimistic and really optimistic at the same exact time. How can he hold both of these views?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't the one who got to interview him, and I would have loved to, quite frankly. But I think you need everything you need to know. You'll see in the photo we have of him, he reminds me of Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. Like, he's got this really cool, you know, he's got the shades on, even though it's not that sunny out, whatever. And he just looks like a guy who would always have something to say at a dinner conversation.
Well, turning to another topic, a book out this month is all about sex called Sex on Earth. Now, how does this book look at reproduction?
Well, Jules Howard, who's a British zoologist who wrote the book, takes a look at the act of reproduction through all kinds of different animals, everything from the humble stickleback fish to ducks to fireflies and horses, and he looks at specific aspects of how reproduction evolved. And you know, this may sound a little bit dry, a little bit textbooky, but he has this fantastic voice, very dry in a good way, very witty and wry. It's a hilarious read, and it's also really fascinating.
It is very interesting, and a lot of us may not know this, but apparently we, as humans, are busy sort of screwing up some of the natural mating rituals that other species have. Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I mentioned the firefly before,
yeah.
And it turns out, in fact, the chapter that we excerpt in our magazine is all about exactly how humans are really messing it up for other animals. You know, fireflies, the female emits the glowing substance from her derriere, and the male says, wow, I really like the look of that glowing substance. I want to get next to that, you know? Well, unfortunately, now the males are way more interested in streetlights. So the poor female is sitting there in the grass, kind of like, hey, hey, and the males are all flying into the streetlights. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing. It's quite tragic. But the fact of the matter is, because of artificial lighting, we're disturbing the normal routines and patterns of reproduction of a lot of different animals.
And there's a similar story, but with sound in oceans and mammal species out there, dolphins and whales.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing how little we know about it because how little we've studied, but they're finding out more and more that these sounds travel for miles, that it's very confusing and upsetting for the animals. And You know, when he's talking about how little research is done, Jules mentions he suspects that if Flipper could tell us more, we would, if we had taught him the sign for "that is a very loud noise, make it stop." You know, the animals really can't tell us, "Hey, guys, shut up, keep it down. We're trying to, like, you know, make babies over here." But, you know, humans, we're kind of the loud, obnoxious neighbors on the planet.
And you are, I think, having a Google Hangout with the author of this. What sorts of what are you going to discuss with him?
We're going to talk about sex.
Oh, boy.
Animal sex.
Ah.
That's all we're going to talk about. But, yeah, it's happening on October 21st, which is a week from Tuesday, at 2 p.m. Central. And you can find out all the information about how to sign up at our website, discovermagazine.com. And we're going to talk a little bit about, well, a lot about animal sex, but we're also going to talk about some of the inspirations that Jules had for just writing this book and some of the perhaps more uncomfortable moments he experienced. But I won't get into that. I'll save it for the hangout.
Well, with this issue, before we move on, of humans interfering with reproduction of species, I mean, is this something that ecologists and environmentalists are starting to take seriously and try to see how we can turn down the light and turn down the noise?
Well, that's part of it, but first they need to understand exactly what's happening. And I would say probably some of the animals that are among the most studied in this particular area are birds, because there have been many studies showing that birds are actually changing their songs, you know, their mating calls to members of the opposite sex. Like if they're near a roadside and certain pitches are lost with all the hubbub of trucks and cars on the road, they will actually evolve in a way that changes their song. And so they're looking at that, and they really need to understand what changes are taking place before they can even figure out how to mitigate the disruption that we're causing.
And we'd like to move on to dinosaurs right now. There's a NOVA special coming out about the first aquatic dinosaur ever discovered. And I got to tell you, I don't know what's more interesting, the dinosaur itself or this, because we've just discovered it, but actually we've known about it for 100 years or so. And that story is also just as fascinating as the dinosaur.
There are so many things that are fascinating about the whole Spinosaurus story. So very briefly, it is the first aquatic dinosaur ever identified. Before we thought dinosaurs were strictly land animals, this dinosaur is very highly adapted to be a fantastic swimmer and have an aquatic lifestyle. So that's one cool thing. Another cool thing, yeah, this guy, biggest dinosaur predator ever. Bigger than T-Rex, bigger than anything else we've seen. So that's another interesting thing. But the backstory about how we found it, lost it, found it again, fascinating. It's actually, as you mentioned, it's been about a century since a German paleontologist named Ernst Stromer found these enormous bones in the Sahara, I believe, in what is now modern-day Egypt. So he brought them back to Munich, studied them, drew them, took some really, you know, kind of shaky photographs of them, and then because he was not on the good side with the Nazis. He and the Nazis did not get along. When he asked them to move the bones during World War II, they said, no, they're staying where they are. And, yeah, they got destroyed in an Allied bombing raid in the 40s. So all real evidence, the bones, were gone. And over the years, because this is such a strange dinosaur, it's got a crocodilian head, it's got these crazy huge flat feet and a weird 8-foot-high sail on its back, because of all these weird factors, paleontologists said, yeah, there were just a bunch of bones he put together from a bunch of different animals. It's not one animal. And it became this kind of like mythic beast. And it's only been very recently, actually I believe this past summer, that another paleontologist was able to find an even more complete skeleton of Spinosaurus to prove, one, this thing really exists, and two, now that they have the bones, they can study the animal in far greater detail than ever before.
Now, there are, and I always get these mixed up, there are reptilian seagoing things that weren't technically dinosaurs, right?
Right. Well, the flying reptiles, there were the pterosaurs, there were those, but there were also marine reptiles like the plesiosaurs.
Right.
And so they were separated actually from dinosaurs.
But this dude's a dinosaur.
This guy, 100% dinosaur, definitely not something you want to meet on your summer vacation.
So tell us a little more. I want to continue a little bit with the story, because the modern finding of it is very interesting too, because the last person who found it had to find it kind of almost sounded like a black market kind of story. He met somebody in a market and the guy wore like a mask and took him out into the desert. And I mean, it's straight out of, you know, Harrison Ford or something like that.
Well, you know, I talked to Nizar Ibrahim, who is the paleontologist. He's of Moroccan and German descent. He's the paleontologist who found the second Spinosaurus. And when I told him, yeah, you know, I watched the Nova special. I got an advanced copy of it. And they make it seem like it's a pretty Hollywood, you know, kind of dramatic movie. And he said, no, no, you don't understand. That's exactly what happened. There's a huge semi-legal market for fossils in Morocco. And he basically just kind of stumbled on this guy and years later realized this guy who was hawking basically Spinosaurus fossils and had to go back, you know, ask this guy, hey, have you seen this guy? You know, he's tall and he has a beard. And do this entire really kind of Hollywood drama to thriller to track this guy down. But he actually did it. And because of the semi-legal trade, you know, the guy was kind of in disguise. And it's this whole other really fascinating and crazy backstory.
Gentlemen, before we let you go, Halloween will have come and gone before we talk to you next. Are you, what, brushing up your Spinosaurus costume for the holiday?
Oh, every year I go as Yersinia Pestis, the Black Death. Can't beat it for Halloween.
You are fun.
Wait, how do you do that? Briefly, what does that costume look like?
A black
it's
sheep?
Easy. I just all wear black. I wear all black, which is pretty much every day for me anyway, so most people don't even notice I'm in costume.
All right, well, we'll watch for you on Halloween. Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Always fun. Thanks, guys.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month with an overview of some of the coolest stories from the world of science.